Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This past week was, as NPR's Supreme Court correspondent Nina Totenberg tweeted, quote, the end of the world as we know it. Justice Anthony Kennedy, for years the ideological center of the High Court and occasionally its high-profile swing voter, informed President Trump of his decision to retire. For progressives, it was clear. The center would no longer hold.
In 1992, Anthony Kennedy's vote saved Roe versus Wade. That
you could have more restrictions on voting rights claims, employment discrimination claims.
Everything to do with women's rights, having to do with gay rights, having to do with solidifying the pro-corporate, anti-worker wing of the Supreme Court.
What happened to separation of powers? What happened to checks and balances in this country? Gone. Gone.
Some noted that Justice Kennedy's reputation as defender of liberalism and civil rights was rather overstated. His vote did determine the decision to legalize same-sex marriage, but it also clinched the decision to subject our elections to unprecedented corporate influence, that is, Citizens United. Another historic Kennedy call, his concurring opinion this past week in Trump v. Hawaii.
It is a 5-4 decision authored by the Chief Justice John Roberts. He says the proclamation, that's Travel Ban 3.0, is squarely within the scope of presidential authority under the INA.
Yes, he stood with his conservative colleagues, although he did add to his opinion this, an anxious world must know that our government remains committed always to the liberties the Constitution seeks to preserve and protect, so that freedom extends outward and lasts. Alas, the hand-wringing following Kennedy's resignation betrays broad fears of a very different outcome. Adam Serwer is a senior editor for The Atlantic. Adam, welcome to OTM.
Thank you for having me.
Donald Trump's travel ban got the go-ahead from the Supreme Court because, as Chief Justice John Roberts put it in his decision, quote, the text says nothing about religion. Well, that's true, but there's also nothing written on a shotgun shell about blowing someone's head off. Is literalism a legal standard?
There's actually a long history of the Supreme Court deciding that something, even if it has the effect of discriminating against a particular group of people, is not discriminatory unless that intent is stamped in the document, regardless of the larger context in which that piece of legislation was passed.
But if text is the only measure of intent, as you pointed out earlier in the week, the court could be upholding Jim Crow laws. Nothing in there declaring blacks to be lesser humans or second-class citizens.
Right. Some Jim Crow laws. So specifically, you know, one of the things I mentioned was the grandfather clause, which conveniently said you can only vote if your grandfather could vote in this period. And what that meant essentially was that there was a cutoff point after which you couldn't vote. Now, it didn't say black people couldn't vote. In fact, it didn't actually technically prevent all black people from voting, since there were some free black people who would have come in under the line. But by Roberts' logic, there's nothing racist about this cornerstone of voter suppression under Jim Crow.
In a 2007 case involving school desegregation, Justice Roberts penned what amounts to like a personal legal mantra. He wrote, quote, the way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race. He's also ruled against ongoing federal intervention in protecting minority voting rights, acknowledging the problem. He says, yeah, it's an issue, but arguing there's no equitable constitutional remedy. And now he says a discriminatory law whose motivation is clear by a vast collection of the president's own words cannot be overturned unless the text of the law confesses its own discriminatory intent. I'm seeing a pattern here.
Yeah, I would say that the more honest version of Justice Roberts' famous line is that the way to stop discriminating on the basis of race is simply to pretend that discrimination on the basis of race is not occurring. Roberts never says, oh, I don't care that these laws discriminate. What he says is the federal government has simply exceeded its powers in this realm. What Roberts has in common with that approach to racial discrimination, he shares with the post-Reconstruction era Supreme Court, which consistently ruled against laws that were meant to protect black rights, not on the grounds that black men had no rights that a white man was bound to respect. Rather, they simply said that the federal government was exceeding its powers, and therefore the laws were unconstitutional.
During the oral arguments and in their decisions, what did the court, the majority in this case, make of the just vast amount of presidential rhetoric and that of his proxies that made very clear that this immigration action was indeed intended to be a Muslim ban? I mean, just for example, this is Trump himself after signing the first version of the travel ban.
This is the protection of the nation from foreign terrorist entry into the United States. We all know what that means. Protection of the nation.
Well, we do all know what that means. It means keeping Muslims out. Justice Sotomayor pointed to that moment, among many, many others, in her dissent. But still, the court's majority managed to be blind to everything. How did they reconcile that?
For one thing, they said, oh, the ban doesn't apply to every majority Muslim country in the world, so it's really not fair to say that it's rooted in anti-Muslim animus. And what Sotomayor's dissent said was that, essentially, that you guys are kidding yourselves, that it's actually quite clear that this was intended this way. Part of what's interesting about this is that the decision overturns Korematsu, the decision justifying Japanese internment during World War II, as rooted in animus. But the Korematsu decision was justified on the grounds that this was necessary for national security. And something similar has happened here. The court has said, you know, this is a national security decision and the executive gets deference in this area. And it's obvious, based on how the order doesn't mention Islam, that this is not actually rooted in animus in the way that the Korematsu decision was. But the logic is actually very similar.
Roberts and his conservative colleagues on the court had scrutinized the travel ban using what the court calls rational basis review. This imagines a reasonable observer who they believe, in this case, would hear all of the president's rhetoric and still not see an anti-Muslim animus. Who gets to decide whether this observer is reasonable as opposed to oblivious?
The court applied rational basis scrutiny and determined that, you know, since the government has a rational basis in trying to prevent terrorism, the government should be referred to in this case. But I think the more disturbing thing is that Roberts has essentially drawn a roadmap for the Trump administration to turn the president's prejudices into law, because what he said is that if you don't mention the group that you're discriminating against, then you can do pretty much whatever you want, even if everybody knows that what you're doing is motivated in animus. What that means is that this case, though for obvious reasons it's been seen as a thing that primarily affects Muslims, is actually going to affect many, many more people as the Trump administration continues to pursue its agenda.
But its decisions aren't necessarily immutable. Is there a chance that this ruling will somehow become undone in my lifetime?
Look, I just want to be clear about something. The implications of a monopoly on the court are tremendous. In the aftermath of Reconstruction, the Supreme Court dismantled every major effort to legislate racial equality in the United States. And in doing so, they helped construct the edifice of Jim Crow that lasted for about a century. So the potential here is really that the Trump administration makes a mark on the United States of America for decades to come. It really should not be understated.
One last straw to grasp at is that all of these decisions, which seem so retrograde to me, are the result of a legitimate ideological question rooted in the framers' intent, and that they are not intrinsically racist, but just part of the ebb and flow of political ideology. And that when push comes to shove, even the conservative jurists, notwithstanding their record to date, will somehow do the right thing.
Well, I would say that they think that they are doing the right thing for society. They think that they're doing their jobs, they're upholding the Constitution. And they're going to continue to do that, no matter how absurd or discriminatory or wrong it feels to their liberal critics.
Adam, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Adam Serwer is a senior editor at The Atlantic.
To quote Nina Totenberg once again, on Tuesday she tweeted that, without audio of today's announcement, there's no way to replicate Sotomayor's fury in a 20-minute dissent from the bench re today's travel ban decision. The justices have spoken many times over the years explaining their views rejecting same-day audio and cameras in the courtroom. So back in 2015, OTM producer Jesse Brenneman composed a song using the justices' own words.
Television in court. I was for it when I first joined the court and switched and remained on that side of it. I do not believe the purpose would be to educate the American people.
It will alter the way in which we hear our cases, the way in which we talk to counsel, the way in which we use that precious hour. Please don't introduce into the dynamic the temptation, the insidious temptation to think that one of my colleagues is trying to get a soundbite for the television. We don't want that. Please, Senator, we don't want that. Please don't introduce the temptation, the insidious temptation.
Television in the court.
The way in which we use that precious, precious hour.
Television in the court.
We'll have to talk together.
We don't want that.
Television in the court.
I think it would be a terrific thing.
Please don't introduce the insidious temptation. Trying to get a soundbite for the television.
Could you argue the opposite position?
I could make a lot of points about educating the public.
If the American people watched our proceeding gavel to gavel, they would never again ask, Jessica Lee, why do you have to be a lawyer to be on the Supreme Court?
When you see what happens, it's an inspiring sight. All nine justices, so prepared, so smart, so thorough, really seeing government at work.
A million people could have seen that oral argument. That would be wonderful.
I have had positive experiences with cameras.
It seems somewhat perverse to exclude the television.
I don't see any problem with having proceedings televised.
So it sounds like you all changed your minds.
The day you see a camera coming into our courtroom, it's going to roll over my dead body.
Regular appearances on TV would mean significant changes in the way my colleagues could conduct their lives. My anonymity is already gone.
Most of the American people would see 15-second takeouts, and those takeouts would not be characteristic of what we do. They would be uncharacteristic.
Yeah, now, but what we see is an article in a newspaper that's out of context.
That's fine. People read that and they say, well, it's an article in a newspaper. But somehow when you see it live, an excerpt live, it has a much greater impact. Television in the court.
Over my dead body.
Good for the public.
Television in the court.
That would be wonderful.
We don't want that.
Television in the court. My anonymity is already gone.
It means I'd have to get my hair done more often, Senator Spector.
Oh. Let me commend you on that last comment.
Jesse Brenneman, who composed the last piece, is hilarious, kind, a forever young old soul. Someone you are so grateful you got to hang out with for a few years. Now, like Mary Poppins, he's flying off this week to move back to his home state of Montana. Yeah, I know, she wasn't from Montana. We'll miss you, Jesse. Hot pie forever.
Godspeed, young man. We will miss you. This is On the Media.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll talk with psychologist Jonathan Haidt about his book, The Anxious Generation.
We're overprotecting in one place, and I'm saying, lighten up, let your kids out. And we're underprotecting in another, and I'm saying, don't let your kids spend 9 hours a day on the internet talking with strange men. It's just not a good idea.
Jonathan Haidt on the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Amid the avalanche of Supreme Court news and the ongoing wretchedness on the border, many in the media took time out this week to address a different crisis, the impending demise of civility.
White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders says she was out for dinner last night in Virginia when she was refused service at a restaurant because she works for the Trump administration.
I was asked to leave because I work for President Trump. We are allowed to disagree, but we should be able to do so freely and without fear of harm.
Cue the pearl clutchers.
The world's getting hotter, and it's not global warming. It's political tension driven by emotion.
No, you're watching the left become an activist mob.
I would say that the polite discourse is inappropriate when there are babies in cages. Now, does that mean that we're...
This particular media meltdown seems to have touched a nerve, perhaps because we've never really settled on how best to live together. And we've been arguing about it for a long, long time. Consider one of history's most effective hecklers, who also hounded a powerful institution. But it wasn't the White House, it was the Vatican, just over 500 years ago.
He by no means invented uncivil disagreement, but Martin Luther was a virtuoso of the religious insult.
Teresa Bejan is an associate professor of political theory at the University of Oxford and author of Mere Civility: Disagreement and the Limits of Toleration.
He really saw uncivil speech and actually other forms of incivility as an essential part of the duty of an evangelical Christian, to put it in modern parlance, to call out the errors of others. When nails or glues, you know, depending on whom you ask, these 95 theological propositions to the door of a church in Wittenberg, and really gets this thing that we begin to think of as the Protestant Reformation going. A few years later, the Pope responds by declaring 41 of those 95 theses heretical. And Luther responds in this stroke of polemical genius by calling the Pope the Antichrist.
Now that's rude.
The Pope, you know, trying to take a page from Luther's book, when he finally does excommunicate Luther, he at the same time declares that so that Martin's followers will share in his shame, they shall henceforth be denominated Lutherans.
The height of rudeness.
Exactly. So many of the denominational labels that we know today begin in this period as really offensive and uncivil religious insults. Puritan starts out as an insult. Someone who is overcome with purifying zeal. Or even Quaker, someone who's quaking in their religious ecstasies. And by the way, when they started out, Quakers were notorious, among other things, for taking their clothes off in public, for interrupting other people's church services by banging pots and pans. And so Luther's real innovation here, and I think what really, really catches on and then leads to the crisis of civility that we begin to see, is that it's a duty of every individual Christian to offend those who are in errors. You have to insult them. You have to frustrate social norms of respectful behavior so as to alert them to the depth and severity of the sin in which they're living.
So let's carry on with this civility debate with two of its earliest and still best-known theorists, Thomas Hobbes and John Locke.
So in the 17th century in England, both Hobbes and Locke are trying to figure out how it's possible for a tolerant society to exist and not dissolve into civil war. How is it possible that those who disagree fundamentally in matters of religion and in politics can nevertheless live together? Because all of the existing evidence on the ground, at least in Europe, seems to be that that was impossible. If you wanted people to coexist peacefully, you could not have religious toleration.
So disagreement then, or the lack thereof, is a matter of life or death.
Absolutely. I mean, it's easy to sort of minimize the stakes of these early modern wars of religion, but we have to remember that the death toll in, you know, the English Civil War alone was per capita upwards of, I think, both world wars combined. Hobbes comes to the conclusion that it's not actually religious difference that's the problem, it's disagreement that's the problem. Mm-hmm. So basically, you could have a society wherein people believe whatever they want, so long as they don't actually disagree about it with one another. So he comes up with this understanding of civility as what I call civil silence. It's basically we can live together peacefully and unmurderously so long as we see our differences as, strictly speaking, not worth disagreeing about.
So Hobbes is suggesting that the people themselves could never be an engine of change because they wouldn't be allowed to argue over their ideas.
Yeah, Hobbes is trying to roll back that kind of empowering of the individual to call out the injustice of the status quo. And what that requires for Hobbes is a kind of absolute sovereign power to govern speech.
Whereas Locke liked argument.
Yeah, absolutely. Because argument is how we learn. He begins to think about civility really in a different way. He says, well, if we're going to disagree productively, what are the constraints that need to be in place on how much difference a tolerant society can have? So we can only disagree within a kind of span of what we might call reasonable disagreements. So one limit is that you can't tolerate atheists because you can't have a civil disagreement with an atheist, basically,
oh.
is his view. But Locke is also really adamant that you can't tolerate Catholics because they see themselves as being loyal to...
The Pope?
The Pope.
So one of the main reasons why we called you is that when you approached this study of civility, you were yourself a civility skeptic.
Yeah, I saw routinely how charges of incivility were used as ways to stifle debate, and that civility was very often a tool of marginalizing the marginal and suppressing dissent.
And then you discovered someone who changed your mind, Roger Williams, a radical Puritan and founder of Rhode Island. He was banished from the Massachusetts Bay Colony, basically for refusing to shut up.
That's exactly right. He's an uncompromising Puritan English Calvinist, and on his own terms, most of the Puritans of Massachusetts Bay were not Christians at all. They were sinners. And he thinks it's his duty to tell them that at every opportunity. He's a really difficult, intolerant Puritan.
So I assume that Rhode Island was an intolerant place.
That is the assumption that we would tend to make. But exactly the opposite happens. When Roger Williams is banished from Massachusetts Bay and he founds the town of Providence on a gift of land from the Narragansett tribe with which he was very friendly, he opens it up for other religious dissenters who've been banished from the colonies to come and worship freely.
Why?
Right. I mean, Williams's idea was that in order to have spiritual or religious purity, you were going to have an absolute wall of separation between church and state and between civil society and religious society. So Rhode Island becomes the first society in the world not to have an established church.
So who lived there? I mean, what sort of dissenters descended on Rhode Island?
Rhode Island became known as a rogue's island and the latrine of New England because just basically everyone who was too wild or uncivil to be tolerated in the other colonies found themselves there. So Catholics, Jews, and then also pagans or American Indians. But what's really exceptional here and where he goes farther than anyone else, really, and I would say farther than even people like Jefferson, is that Williams thinks that not only do all of these erroneous doctrines, all these erroneous consciences have this right to live together in civil society, they all also have a right and a duty to evangelize for their errors.
Everyone has to be incredibly annoying, is what you're saying.
And it's not all the time. It's not 24/7, although Williams himself seemed to have quite a lot of stamina. But it's the idea that part of what it is to live in the world is to have the courage of one's convictions and to care for the souls of one's fellow citizens. And if you think you're right, then you have a duty to try to convince others that they're wrong.
Politely.
It's not that you have to be polite. Indeed, this kind of no-holds-barred evangelical debate is going to be the cause of a lot of offense. I think, you know, one thing I think Williams would want us to think about is why we set the standard for success so high. Surely unmurderous coexistence itself is a precious achievement. And if we keep on making the best the enemy of the good in social life, then we really do risk losing these kinds of, you know, yes, they're minimal, yes, they seem maybe less than aspirational, but that there's actually something really, really precious about
not killing each other.
Yeah, this unmurderous coexistence. We can't take it for granted.
So when applying the lessons of Rhode Island mm-hmm. to the nation today, people aren't engaging or complaining or insulting necessarily because of beliefs, but because of what we're seeing, because of actions. Tearing kids away from families at the border, the destruction of the environment. Do the lessons of civility still apply in this mm-hmm. setting?
I mean, one thing worth remembering is that the religious disagreements that are at stake in the 17th century, they're not just differences of opinion about beliefs. They're also serious disagreements about how we should organize society, how we should live together. Mm-hmm. Look, you know, I'm offering a theory of civility, not of justice, not of democracy, right? Civility is civility.
But actually, civility isn't civility, because just in our discussion, we've seen it redefined over and over again.
So mere civility, on my view, is this conversational virtue that's minimal conformity to norms of respectful behavior that are needed in order to keep a conversation going. But most fundamental to that is just the willingness to have the conversation. Mm-hmm. We mustn't give up on one another. And that's the kind of evangelical core of mere civility on the Williams model. Mm-hmm. It doesn't deny at all the importance of crying out against injustice. Indeed, it accommodates crying out against injustice. But it says that when we call out injustice, we do so in a way that remains committed to sharing our fate in society together.
I mean, you've seen people trying to argue on cable news. Usually they start yelling, then they start talking over each other, and then they cut to a commercial.
All just for the benefit of those watching who agree with them already.
Mm-hmm.
And I think both sides have so much to learn from a radical, obstreperous evangelical Puritan who actually just had the courage of his convictions and just continually had those uncomfortable conversations that every kind of theorist of toleration told him were impossible. And I think that's the kind of radical hope on which American democracy is really built.
Teresa, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Teresa Bejan is an associate professor of political theory at the University of Oxford and author of Mere Civility, Disagreement, and the Limits of Toleration. Ever since the 2016 election, we've been pondering the obliteration of our norms. But seen in the context of history, that's normal. The First World War, the Depression, the Second World War, jazz, rock and roll, the Vietnam War, alienation, and the internet. Keith Bybee, author of How Civility Works, says every generation of Americans has found a reason to bemoan the end of courtesy and respect. But the fact is, civility can be a tool of oppression.
Jim Crow segregation was surrounded and sustained by a racial etiquette. Martin Luther King spoke about this quite eloquently in his letter from Birmingham Jail. You don't call the wife of an African American Mrs. She always gets addressed by her first name. An African American male adult is never Mr. He is Boy or John. In order to be a member of polite society defined by such a racial etiquette was to enact through your conventional good behavior a racial hierarchy. The sit-ins, which were in part efforts to change laws, were direct confrontations with that etiquette. It wasn't ever enough for the civil rights movement just to seek policy change. There had to also be social change. One form of civility extended to all races so that it would be possible for people to interact as equals.
Talk about then how etiquette violation can be a political tactic. You offer a really good example of what you call manner-based intimidation, the group called ACT UP.
That's right. So during the 1980s in the Reagan administration, as the AIDS crisis was becoming more and more manifest, decorum at the time precluded discussion of non-heterosexual practices. decorum at the time also sidelined or marginalized expressions of grief or mourning in public spaces. ACT UP, to bring greater attention to the AIDS crisis and to demand a more proactive response from government, abandoned appropriate behavior. They staged these quite dramatic takeovers of town hall or city hall meetings and legislative hearings. They staged die-ins. This tactic initially was understood as counterproductive. The idea is that they should play along with the rules of civility that are currently in place. Today, it's called tone policing. When you confront someone who's engaged in protest or some form of obstreperous behavior, and you say to them, you'd be a lot more effective if you would calm down. And what it does, right, is it redirects the conversation away from the issue that the protester is trying to call attention to and says, no, the problem is not the AIDS crisis or the problem is not police brutality. Instead, the problem is your style of complaint.
Athletes taking the knee, denounced as unpatriotic and disrespectful.
Policing of tone, I don't think, is just atmospherics. It really is a way of conveying a different understanding of the respect that people are owed.
Mm-hmm.
It taps into fundamental issues.
From respectfully taking a knee to yelling at a diner to cursing out the president, I wonder if there is some sort of range, and can you distinguish among them, or are they all the same thing?
You know, there's no authoritative institution that tells us what civility is, that tells us how to update civility when time has changed. That kind of debate surfaces sometimes a deeper criticism that we should be without civility at all. Like, let's just say what we think. And the patron saint of this perspective is John Stuart Mill and his powerful essay on liberty, where he said, you know, we should have a contentious public culture. We should have people shouting at each other in restaurants.
He was deeply suspicious of civility as a tool of repression.
Accusing people of being rude or uncivil is a way of, in Mill's language, stigmatizing them as being immoral. Interestingly, Mill himself ultimately came down in favor of civility. He thought that there should be rules of temperate speech if they could be designed and implemented in a way that would give respect to all merited arguments.
And I thought he was a realist.
That does sound pretty soft-headed, right? And so you wonder, why would someone like Mill shift gears like that? Why would this hard-headed proponent of contention and disputation suddenly go wobbly? I actually think it grew out of his very commitment to robust, uninhibited, wide-open debate. What civility and really what good manners do are provide you a mechanism for conveying your integrity. He sought and he thought rules of temperate speech, which were more egalitarian and fair, would actually underwrite a free speech society.
But you've already argued that civility is political, and therefore the rules will always be determined by the powerful.
It's also the case, though, right, that politics is never finished. So it's a call to action because civility is constituted through political conflict. So get out there. Join the argument. Mill, in general, said you can go as far as you want so long as it doesn't hurt another person.
Finish up then with a certain paradox that you alluded to when you said that John Stuart Mill thought that civility was, in a sense, a reflection of character. And then you went and you quoted François de la Rochefoucauld, who said, hypocrisy is the homage vice pays to virtue. What he meant is, even if you're lying about how you feel, you're still behaving in a virtuous way, and that's better for society.
When we're honest with one another, we often discover not our true commonalities. What we discover is how much we really don't like each other. And if we're in that kind of society, which is riven with disagreement, yet we still need to get along.
Civility enables us to lie in order to get along. And what's wrong with that?
Right. Well, yes. Now, you can say, well, I don't want to live in a society where people aren't really telling me what they really think. And I think that that perspective is really held by only people who have never lived with complete honesty, which is very unpleasant. civility gives us an easily deployable means for conveying a basic decency.
At the same time, you're okay with yelling at Kristen Nielsen in a restaurant.
Right. I contain multitudes, Brooke. Shouting in the restaurant is part and parcel of determining what will count as our baseline of respect we owe one another in public life. So that's part of the making of the sausage. Once the sausage is made, and this metaphor is going to break down pretty quickly, then people can pose with that sausage in a way that's inauthentic and hypocritical.
Okay.
Really? I think we should keep this in. I think this sausage thing could be big.
But the thing is that a lot of people worry about the slippery slope, but our rules of discourse seem to have ebbed and flowed forever.
It's not as if having gone in one direction, we can't go backwards. We've seen that our manners have become more inclusive and egalitarian over time. But having made that progress doesn't mean that we couldn't step backward. I don't think we're going to dispense with civility. I think we might radically change the way in which we operationalize it over time. But I don't think that we will shed the requirement for civility. I don't think it's something we get over. I think rather it's the means through which we realize our ideals of justice and fairness.
Thank you very much.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Keith Bivey is a judiciary studies professor at the Syracuse University School of Law and author of How Civility Works.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. As the argument over civility rages in Washington in the media, civil society is quietly thriving in small towns all over America. In 2013, James Fallows of The Atlantic and author and linguist Deborah Fallows started what would turn into a five-year expedition to small towns mostly overlooked, taking the measure of lives lived outside the media lens. They chronicled lessons learned in their book, Our Towns, a 100,000-mile journey into the heart of America.
We had this vehicle, literally and figuratively, of a propeller airplane that we'd used for a long time. So we thought, what would it be like to go out into the middle of the country and not ask people how they felt about Obama, Hillary Clinton, and the Republicans, but how they felt about the life of their towns?
And I'm supposed to believe that this was really about using the plane to take a trip and not about creating a trip in order to use the plane.
We might have different answers for that one.
More than 5 years ago, I put a post in the Atlantic site saying, tell us the story of your town. We're looking for a place not usually in the media and a place that had some kind of problem. Factory closing, natural disaster, whatever. We got about 1,000 replies to that. We heard from 49 of the 50 states and lots of small places, and where we ended up going, on average, they were poorer than the national average.
First day in town, we'd go see the usual suspects, someone from the newspaper, somebody maybe in the economic development territory. We'd talk to the librarian, and we'd ask, what's the story here? Who drives this town? So after that first day, I would go to the library and the schools, and Jim would go down to Main Street and talk with the city officials, and then we'd meet up at the brew pub.
The brew pubs, they seem to come up a lot.
Well, yes, and just as you have correctly intuited that I was looking for a way to take a long, airplane trip, so too I've been looking for a way to hang out at brew pubs. Every state now has a thriving craft brew industry that employs a lot of people, and it's been a real vector of urban redevelopment. Because breweries look for a lot of real estate cheap, they go to fringe areas of town. It's sort of like the arts in being a way to rehabilitate parts of town.
A brew pub is a sign that a town is doing well. You offer a number of indications.
10.5 signs of civic success, and 10 of them are serious, and the half is the brew pub. But the city by city, we would say most places, there's this sense of reinvention and renewal and agency. And we ended up with this matrix of things that would make you think this town was moving ahead.
one sign of civic success is that people living in the town know the civic story. What's that mean?
Columbus, Mississippi. Kids in the high school go to the town cemetery. Their seminal history happened during the Civil War. It was a hospital town. They'll choose people in those graves, do the research at the county libraries, and then create reenactments of stories that would have happened in everyday real life there. And you can imagine that they're heavy with racial confrontations. They go to the cemetery in full regalia and present them as plays and as musicals for the people of the town. They do it every year.
You also talked about the use of language in recasting the narrative. Was it Eastport, Maine, where they were underplaying the D words, like decline or depressed? The D words
became the re words, right? The depressing, denounce, deplore became reinvigorate, renovate, renew. A few of the influential people in the town just fed up with the negativity about which their town was written, went on an education campaign to take out those D words and put in those re words and make people use those words. And it's a small enough town that actually seemed to kind of work.
Another element of civic success, which I think is really relevant now, is the successful town is open.
Communities are aware of this as a way to revive themselves.
Yes, yeah, so we actually just happened by chance to three or four towns where there was a significant proportion of refugee resettlement. Sioux Falls, South Dakota, Erie, Pennsylvania, Burlington, Vermont. And in Dodge City, it was an immigrant population, mostly Hispanic. Sioux Falls had been receiving refugees, mainly started by the Lutheran services and Catholic charities. It's often these religious groups that begin taking in refugees to settle there and have been taking wave after wave since the Vietnam War. There's something like 60 languages in the public schools of Sioux Falls. And here's a language bit that you hear in all of these towns, which is, we need each other. Because in Sioux Falls, it's the Muslim population who are working in the slaughterhouses.
In the pig slaughterhouses.
The policemen are culturally trained for each new group of refugees who come in and might bring different problems. Like when you pull a guy over and he's trying to bribe you out of a ticket, you are aware of what happens in his home country and you address that in a cultural way. The town has a remarkable flexibility and resilience.
Another one of your 10 and a half signs of civic success is public-private partnerships, which reminds me of the hot sidewalks of Holland, Michigan.
Yeah. So this is something where I went through a real cultural change, and I can tell I am different from my friends here in D.C. because of this. I think in D.C., all of your BS detectors turn on when you hear the phrase public-private partnership because you think just some log rolling or lobbying thing. But in city after city, people could point to a bridge and say this was the public-private partnership, or a retraining program we saw in Mississippi that was having these people coming in from essentially no previous work to get high-wage jobs in a steel factory. And then Holland, Michigan, it's right on the eastern shore of Lake Michigan. It gets like 10 feet of snow a year, and a civic father there, who actually is a relative of Betsy DeVos, but who grew up there, who's a whole different story. Mm-hmm. But he decided that he would try to save the town by underwriting half of the cost of piping waste heat water from the city's power generating plant downtown in plastic tubes under all the streets and sidewalks of downtown Holland to melt the snow. This happened, you know, like a generation ago, and Holland was just revolutionized by being in the snow belt and having no snow ever on the streets and sidewalks.
Another more traditional example of this was what we saw in Greenville, formerly an old textile mill town and now has a lot of big industry like BMW and GE and Michelin.
And you drew an interesting comparison between Greenville, South Carolina, and Burlington, Vermont.
from the national media's perspective, there couldn't be two more opposite towns than Greenville and Burlington. Greenville, South Carolina, it's the home of Bob Jones University. Trey Gowdy is their congressman. Burlington, Vermont, by contrast, Bernie Sanders was the mayor. The two contending parties are the Democrats and the Socialists. And so these are really different cities on the national grid, but you would think they were the same. The mayor works with the industry, the universities, the NGOs.
And in Greenville, the traditional example of this public-private partnership with these companies, they heavily engage with the public school system there because the companies wanted to build a prepared and energetic employment base for the future. So they went in with the school system and decided to build a brand new school in one of the most distressed parts of town. They opened the A.J. Wittenberg Elementary School of Engineering, where the entire curriculum is kind of infused with baby engineering concepts. And then they graduate to the middle school and insert all these kinds of arts into the STEM program to make it a STEAM program because they want these kids to learn how to argue, to debate, to write, to collaborate, to negotiate, because you don't just want basic engineers. You want these full-fledged people.
And in Burlington, there was also an incredible educational effort.
Yes, and as would be completely appropriate for Burlington, you might guess that it was a charter school of sustainability, right in the, again, the distressed heart of town where there were a lot of refugees. They opened up this school with the engagement of just about every organization in town. It's the seventh generation.
Cosmetics.
Eco Products,
yeah,
are big sponsors. The bike store delivered all kinds of bikes. The YMCA sent down teachers to teach the kids how to swim in Lake Champlain, just a walk from the school. What we found in many of these towns are schools that suit the place that they're in.
Now, one thing you didn't do is talk about national politics.
It is actually the least interesting thing you can talk about with people. Our natural reflex in the media is to say, oh, this is the most divided time ever for the country, et cetera, et cetera. And that is true if you're talking about national politics. It is not true if you look at the way that cities decide to tax themselves to pay for schools, or the way that they are actually absorbing immigrants. So the feel of most of interior America is very different from the tone of cable news.
Okay, so what was the feel, say, in Wyoming? You were there right after the election. The majority had voted for Trump.
So we were in both Cheyenne and Laramie for about a week after the election. There was an overwhelming landslide for Trump there, 3-1 or so. People we talked to were very glad, most of them very glad that Trump had won. But simultaneously, they were saying, well, we hope this doesn't screw up NAFTA, because, of course, all of our exports to Mexico depend on that. We hope it doesn't screw up the immigration system. And you could make fun of that for sort of what were they thinking. But also, it struck me as just the accelerating disconnection between the almost religious passions that animate national political divisions and the actual stuff of life, where the people there recognized that their economy depended on international trade, their labor force depended on flows of people with different kinds of visas. So they didn't want to change any of that. But just if you ask them on national politics, they hated Hillary and thought Trump would shake things up.
Okay. Here's the thing. I read your columns after the election, Jim, and I didn't hear any more eloquent anguish than what you were expressing. Do you feel like you missed something?
You recall after the election, there was this out there riff that only if you had been out there, you would understand the fury, the bitterness, the dystopia, the hellscape. And we had been out there for the previous couple of years. And our observation is that except when it comes to these national passions of how you feel about Hillary Clinton in specific, Barack Obama, the liberals, or Donald Trump, that if you do not sort of puncture that little sack of bile, the rest of the fabric works the way that you would think a society like this basically should work with all of the imperfections. And so I don't think we missed the temper of the country. I think what was missed is the anomalous way Trump was able to win, from James Comey to the exact complexion of the Electoral College. A thousand things had to go in a certain direction for him to end up with a deficit of 3 million votes, but ending up in control of the government. I think I wrote in The Atlantic after the election that this was the worst blow the American idea had received in my lifetime. But I testify to you that this is not representative of the fabric of the country in its daily life. And I feel like there's a struggle between all the forces of darkness at the national level and all these forces of renewal at the local level. So at least shining a light on that is something that we wanted to try to do.
I want to thank you both for these stories.
Well, thank you, Brooke, for giving us a chance to talk about it.
Thank you.
James and Deborah Fallows are the authors of Our Towns, a 100,000-mile journey into the heart of America.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, Michael Loewinger, Leah Fetter, and John Hanrahan. We had more help from Kate Brown and Meg Harney, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer and Greg Rippon.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.